Great American Ballpark. It's the Better Off Red podcast. Here's your host, Jamie Ramsey.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us for episode 2 of the Better Off Red podcast. We cut the ribbon on the podcast last week with the one and only Dimitri Young. And we keep it rolling today with one of the best pitchers in the history of the Reds franchise, Jim Maloney. We have Reds news coming up, but first, here's this week's ear candy from the Chicago five-piece band, 11th Day Dream. From one of the truly great rock and roll albums from 2015, that's the band 11th Day Dream with the song Go Tell It. Their latest LP is entitled Works for Tomorrow, and it's available now on iTunes. Before we get to this week's guest, let's cover some news from around Reds country. The Reds announced on Wednesday that Assistant General Manager Dick Williams has been promoted to the role of Senior Vice President and General Manager and will assume those duties immediately. Walt Jocketty will remain the club's president of baseball operations and continue to oversee the department. Williams joined the Reds baseball operations staff in 2005, and since then has been involved in every aspect of that department. Jocketty was quoted in Wednesday's Reds press release as saying, "As is the case with any business, it's critical to have a succession plan in place. Dick has been here for 10 years, he's learned the business, and we are confident he is ready to take on the GM responsibilities." In other news, former Cincinnati Reds outfielder Eddie Milner passed away on Monday. Milner, who played for the Reds from 1980 until 1986, and then again in 1988, was known for his blazing speed and excellent defense. The Columbus native appeared in the 1987 Major League postseason as a member of the San Francisco Giants. In recent years, Milner made multiple appearances at Reds Hall of Fame events and served as a Reds fantasy camp coach in January 2015. Eddie Milner was 60 years old. Join me at the Holy Grail Banks on Tuesday, November 10th, as we begin another season of Better Off Red Baseball Trivia. It will take place immediately following the season premiere of the popular Reds Hot Stove League show hosted by Marty Brenneman. All of the action begins at 6 p.m., so I hope you'll join us for the Reds Hot Stove League show, followed by Better Off Red Baseball Trivia, live at the Holy Grail Banks, Tuesday, November 10th. Our guest this week threw a 10-inning no-hitter for the Reds in 1965 and a conventional 9-inning no-no in 69. In a game against the Mets at Crosley Field in 1965, he lost a no-hitter in the 11th inning when Johnny Lewis led off the frame with a home run. He won 20 or more games twice, including in 1965 when he went 20-9 with an 8.1 WAR and a 2.54 ERA in over 255 innings pitched. He accumulated over 1,600 strikeouts over a 12-year big league career. He's considered one of the best pitchers to ever put on a Reds uniform. This is Jim Maloney. Hi, Jim Maloney. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Jamie. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Would like to first take an opportunity here to say thanks for coming on the Better Off Red podcast. We really appreciate you coming on here with us. You're a Reds Hall of Famer and one of my all-time favorites. And, you know, we've met in Reds Fantasy Camp, and I see you around the ballpark and every once in a while, and especially in spring training when you come as an instructor with the Reds. And I just wanted to welcome you on, and we're going to talk a little bit about some stuff. How about that?
Hey, all right. I'm glad that you thought of me, and I'm looking forward to sharing a few thoughts with you.
All right, great. Well, my first question for you, Jim, is when I say the name Johnny Lewis, what kind of memories does that bring back?
Well, that's pretty hard to forget about Johnny Lewis. Johnny Lewis was a player for the New York Mets, and the no-hit game I had at Crosley Field in 1965, I pitched 10 innings of no-hit baseball, and score was 0-0, and I went out in the top of the 11th inning, and he had a home run off me, so I ended up losing that game 1-0. So Johnny Lewis, in fact, I'm asked about Johnny Lewis a lot of times when I go around the country doing certain things.
I saw that you know, he's had some success against you in the past, and did you ever get a chance to really did you know Johnny at all?
No, I didn't. I didn't know him. I just knew him as a player for the Mets, and we didn't fraternize too much in those days like they do today. So the only the players that I knew were teammates, and they got traded maybe to another team or something. But I didn't know a lot about a lot of the players personally. I didn't want anybody to know on the opposition what kind of a person I was. I was trying to make a living pitching, and I wasn't, sometimes you get a hit and you get on first base, and I can remember several first basemen, Dick Stewart and some of those guys, they want to start a conversation with you. And I would never acknowledge that I was even listening to them.
I was looking at the box score of that game that you were talking about, which was, incredible that you pitched, not only a 9-inning no-hitter, but you went into the 10th inning, or you went into the 11th inning with a no-hitter. That was in June of 65. You only gave up 2 hits that game. Do you remember who the other hit was off of?
I think it was Roy McMillan. He hit a little bopper over my head or something. It was an infield hit, I believe.
That's exactly right. Roy McMillan, former Red shortstop. You had 18 strikeouts that game. How many pitches do you think you threw?
I threw a lot. I don't know exactly how many I threw on that day, but, 2 months later, I was in the same situation as I was at Crosley Field. I was sitting on the bench in Wrigley Field in Chicago, and I'm sitting there on the bench, and I'm looking at the scoreboard. After 9 innings, I've got another no-hitter going, and the score is 0-0. And a lot of things go through your mind, it'd be nice to pitch a no-hitter and win, and it so happened that the first no-hitter, I got beat by Johnny Lewis, as you said. And sitting there on the bench looking out, I've just pitched 9 innings against the Cubs and have given up no hits. And I got to go out, I'm thinking, if this happens to me again, I might be the only pitcher in the history of baseball that would throw 2 extra inning no-hitters and get beat in both games. But as it turned out, I was in the on-deck circle, and Leo Cardenas was our shortstop. And we were hitting in the top of the 10th inning, and I think there was one out. And he hit a ball and went right down the foul line and hit the foul pole down the left field line at Wrigley. And it was 6 inches to the left. It was foul, and it just hit the tick the foul pole. So he got a home run, and then I went out in the bottom of the 10th inning, and I got him out with no hits. And so in a matter of a 2-month period there, I had thrown 10-inning no-hitters, and I'd won one and I'd lost one. And in the Chicago game, I know for a fact that I threw 187 pitches. So I would imagine that I was pretty close to the same thing at the Mets deal with all the strikeouts.
You don't, you know, it's funny that you say that 180 some odd pitches. If a pitcher did that today, I think before the game was even over, the manager would be fired.
You know, that's sad. That's my opinion. I think that, you know, these programs, these pitchers, you know, we get all the giant games and it's the same thing. They keep talking about the people that are announcing the game. As soon as they have 87, 88 pitches, they start bringing that up. Now, you can listen to it during the series playoffs and stuff and all that kind of stuff. They start mentioning it, and it's usually around the fifth inning. If it all depends if the guy strikes out a few more, he'll reach that point a little bit earlier. But so many times a pitcher has a lead in a ball game, and he gets that fifth inning, and he gets to 100 pitches, and or in the fourth inning, he gets right close to 100 pitches. He got to go out fifth inning, and he has to complete that fifth inning to get it to be eligible to win that ball game if he's ahead. And he goes back out there, and he has a mental thing. They have mental things where they can't finish. They get to 100 pitches, and that's it. They're all programmed. You know, all these pitchers are programmed just to throw 100 pitches. And I don't know. I don't see what that's all about, really. I mean, it's they say they protect their arms and everything, but it seems like to me they got more Tommy John surgeries before than they ever had. I know when I played, they didn't know what Tommy John surgery was until Tommy John had the surgery. And then there, you know, there was a few guys after that. But now it seems like these pitchers, even though they're monitored real close, that they're having so much arm trouble that I don't know. I don't know. I can't tell you. I'm not a medical doctor or whatever it is. But I don't think it's by not throwing 100 pitches or five innings or whatever comes first.
100 pitches, you were just warming up, right?
Yeah, I just broke into a sweat.
Now, you talked about the two, if you include that 11 inning, you know, the game in which you got defeated by the Mets on Johnny Lewis's homer. You talked about that when you talked about the 10 inning no hitter that you pitched. A lot of people don't realize that you threw another no hitter. You threw a conventional 9 inning no hitter as well.
Yeah. And, in April of, 1969, I had threw a no-hitter against the Houston Astros, and that was at Crosley Field, and I got real good run support. I think we got 10 runs, and so that was sort of, you might say, a walk in the park. But you know, there's so much luck involved no-hitters. You know, I remember my roommate Johnny Edwards. He just got traded to Houston, and he was hitting against me. You know, we were playing against each other at that time, and he was like a big brother to me. He was a couple years older, and he caught my first no-hitter, and he caught all the, we came up in the minor leagues together, and you know, he was a real good buddy. But anyway, that during that game he was catching, and there hadn't been anybody hit a ball that was resembled a hit, and he came up, I don't know, fifth or sixth inning and something, and I threw a ball inside, and he hit it off the fist, and he hit a sort of a looper over shortstop, and you know, when you see it go, you think, well, that's, you know, that's in there, going to be a hit, it's going to fall for a hit. And Darryl Chaney went back and dove and made some kind of a laid out catch and put it out, and that helped preserve the no hitter for that day. I remember that.
Wow, that's incredible. And let me ask you, Jim, were no-hitters kind of like, as far as the atmosphere and the tension, was it as prevalent then as it is now? I mean, like now, you know, we get alerts on our telephones when there's a guy in the fifth inning with a no-hitter. And guys don't sit next to the pitcher on the bench, or they don't talk to him in the dugout. Was it the same kind of like that back then?
Yeah, it was, as far as that part of it is, you know, when you know how all the players know, you know, you got a no-hitter fifth or sixth inning, and You know, they sort of leave you alone. They left me alone anyway. You know, during a game, I pitched my game, and I didn't want to be bothered. I was concentrating on, what I needed to do, who was going to come up in the next inning, and how I needed to do what I needed to do to get that first hitter out. And so that's never changed. But the media thing, you know, as you well know, with all the, the television and the social media and all that kind of stuff, and people right away, you know, a guy has a no-hitter going and comes over the screen and that stuff. In those days, a guy would have a no-hitter going and probably nobody would know about it until they picked up a paper the next day and read some box scores in Cincinnati or Chicago or whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's it's a whole different kind of atmosphere, and, the way things are today, is it's a lot different, like you said, with the social media and the MLB Network and all of that
right.
kind of stuff. And it's kind of unique that you said that a lot of folks wouldn't know until they picked up the paper the next day. I think that's kind of, that to put that into kind of perspective, that's, we'll never experience anything like that again.
No, that's right. You know, I told Jim Turner, our pitching coach, he always told us, our pitchers, and I pitched under Jim Turner in Nashville, and then he later on became a pitching coach there at Cincinnati. But he said, when you're going to start, like I was a starter my entire career outside of maybe the first year I started and I pitched out of the bullpen a little bit as a long man relief. But as he always told me, he said, the best thing you can do is spend, in those days, I think he said 20 cents, and you buy, in between starts, you buy a newspaper and you follow the box scores of the team you're going to pitch against the next time out. And you go over the hitters and you can see who's getting one hit, two hits, and you can tell. So when you pitch against somebody, that you know who's hot and who's not. Now you don't have to do that. All I have to do is watch ESPN and they tell you who's hot and who's not. And you don't have to go through all that stuff. But I did that for pretty much my whole career. Is I bought newspapers. We go on the road. I was going to pitch two games on the road. I would start buying and looking. Like if we were going to play Pittsburgh, the second team in, I would start buying and looking at the Pittsburgh box scores to see who was getting the hits and who wasn't.
Yeah, nowadays they have the advanced scouting video. They have every pitch on video and film, and you didn't have the luxury of having that kind of stuff back then.
No, but you really had to. You have to learn. I might have been able to get a certain hitter out a certain way, and Bob Perkey could not get that hitter out the same way I threw because he was a different type of pitcher. So it's more of a trial and error method. That, if guys like balls inside or they like the ball outside. But it's pretty much a rule that even today, to simplify things down, most right-handed hitters like the ball up and out over the plate. And they like to look for the ball inside so they can jerk the ball down the line up. And most left-handed hitters like the ball down and sort of in. And so I try to just stay out of those zones, And there are some exceptions. Don Clendenin was a low ball, fastball hitting first baseman for the Mets. And, you find that out so you don't pitch up. If you don't know, like Perkey could get guys out where I couldn't get them out that way and vice versa. So each pitcher has to learn how to, and that takes through experience. You get the chance to pitch against them a few times and you see how they're working against you and how, but basically if you just try to keep the ball down on right-handers and you can pitch the ball down on left-handers if you pitch the ball away and you can go up and in or up and away on left-handers, you stay, above the belt, right? Because they like that ball down and in so they can golf it out, get some wood on it. So that's pretty much true in, today's hitters.
Did you have any, on the days that you pitched, did you have any routines or anything that you did? I think you kind of touched on it earlier about how, you were kind of left alone. Were you just kind of like a different guy on the day that you pitched where you didn't want to be bothered? And wanted to focus on the task at hand?
Yeah, absolutely. I was okay at home, but once I left, I lived up in Mount Airy, and once I left the house up there and I was pitching that day, I would get in the clubhouse and I would pretty much isolate. I mean, if somebody came up and asked me a question or did something, I mean, I would, but I wasn't around some of the guys play cards, idle time and stuff, or joke around a little bit, and I wasn't into that kind of a mode, and they know it, you know, and I knew it when other starters were the same way. So it's all an individual type thing, but you get psyched up to pitch, and you're one day, and if you try to have a good day at the office, and if you don't have a good day at the office, you got to wait 4 more days or 5 more days to get out there and go at it again. So I pretty much was by myself.
Yeah, as you know, we talk about some of the changes in the game these days, but I think that's one that has remained, consistent throughout the years, is the pitcher, remaining in his zone and doesn't want to be bothered. I know the media, there's a protocol for the media not to talk to the pitcher the day that he pitches. I think some of those things have remained the same as the years have gone by.
Right, right.
You know, something about you, Jim, that I didn't really realize until I looked up today, you're the only player to appear on both the Reds' 1961 and 1970 World Series teams.
Well, that's about halfway right. I was on the 61 team. Yeah, I was 21 years old, and I think I was the youngest pitcher to pitch in the World Series. I didn't do very good. I came in relief of Joy Jay, and he gave up about 5 or 6 runs, and I came in and put some more gas on the fire. But I got to pitch in the World Series, and that's one of my goals. Is when I started out that I would like to pitch in the World Series. In 1969, I was about in the middle of the season. I was like 3 wins and no losses, plus a no hitter in that deal, and then. About, I don't know, maybe mid-season, I started having problems with my left heel. Mm-hmm. The back of the heel where the shoe, in those days, we didn't have those Adidas shoes or something. We had the hard kangaroo leather-type shoe that you mm-hmm. had to wear real tight on your feet, half size smaller, and it would rub around the back part of my heel, and it bothered me. It bothered me when I was running and when I touched it, or when that thing, the back of the shoe would rub across it. It would hurt, and I didn't know what was going on. And so I told the trainer about it, and he didn't seem to say anything. So finally I said, "Well, you better tell Housen." I said, "This thing's not getting any better." And I said, "So anyway, I went up to Housen's office, and I told him. In the meantime, they X-rayed it. They had somebody look at it. Dr. Ballou, he was our team doctor. He was a surgeon. And so they couldn't see anything and this and that. So Housen called me up. I didn't call me in. I didn't make an appointment with him. So he sits me down. And he says, "Well, we had you checked out." And he says, "There's nothing that shows bad on the x-rays or nothing." And he says, "The only thing I can think about," he says, "you don't have any pain tolerance." That's what he told me.
Hmm.
He says, "You don't have any pain tolerance." He says, You don't know how to take pain. And I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, Bob Gibson, see, Housen came from St. Louis in 67. And so he says, "Well," he brings up Gibson's name. He says, "Well, Bob Gibson's got pain tolerance. He goes out, he's hurting, and he said, he pitches through it." I says, I do the same thing. I says, most of the times I'm stiff and sore from the time before. And after, if I get by the first inning or second inning, I loosen up and I can go ahead and pitch. I said, I don't have any problem there. This is my heel, and it bothers me to run, and it bothers me when I pitch, when I land on it. Well, he says, "You got to bite the bullet." He says, "You got to pitch." So anyway, I really resented the fact that he talked to me that way. And so I left. So I built a pad up in my shoe. I had a leather sponge deal, and I wrapped it with tape. So where my left shoe, my heel would stick up almost my foot would come out of my shoe almost, but it would just hang on very little bit away from that spot. Mm-hmm. But still, when I ran, it still bothered me. So I finished out that year, and I never said anything. I kept pitching, and I had some arm problems, and I missed a few starts, I'm sure. But the next year, I go to spring training, and they wanted to cut me. You know, I was 12-5, and I had the lowest earned run average on the team, but my wins had fallen off. And I was 12-5, and they wanted to cut me $2,000. I said, I'm not going to take a cut, so I was holding out. I had my family down in Tampa, and I would go over to the ballpark, and I'd talk to Housen. And so he says, you know, we're not going to give you the money. You know, we want you to sign for a $2,000 cut. You either sign for that, you're not going to play. So I went back to the house and where I was staying with my family, and talked it over with my wife, and I called my dad. I told him what was the deal, and he said, well, you do what you feel that you need to do. He says, I'm pretty sure that they probably will come up with your same salary as you made the last year. That's what my dad said. And he said, if you wanted to hold out, you can hold out. So I said, okay, I'll hold out for another week. So anyway, I went back. I didn't show up at the ballpark, and I didn't hear anything. And anyway, I got a call. I got a call from Marvin Miller, and he was a union guy from Pittsburgh. And he was a guy that got things going. He got meal money raised up right away. We didn't know. You know, these owners were telling us certain things, and we had no way to bargain on anything. We had no agents, nothing of that stuff. But anyway, Marvin Miller calls me, and he says, you're holding out. He says, do you think you're going to sign? I says, you know, Marvin, I said, I don't know. I said, they want to cut me to only $2,000, but I said, I was 12-5. I had the lowest earn run average on all of the ball club that year. And I said, I don't, you know, I would play for the same salary. So I was talking about a $2,000 swing there. And, you know, that was a lot of money in those days. I mm-hmm. mean, 70, I don't know what compared to today, what it was. So he said, if you want to sit it out, he says, Kurt Flood is, we're going to try to challenge the reserve clause. And so where you don't have to be bound down to one player, one team, mm-hmm. and then you go to another team. And he says, I can't guarantee you that you'll be blackballed out of baseball or whatever, but he said, if you're willing to, you know, do that, you know, we'd have somebody who would represent you and go from there. And I said, well, let me think about it. So I hung up, and I called him back about 5 days later. I hadn't heard anything from Housen or anything. And I told him, I said, Marvin, I said, I don't have enough guts. That's exactly what I told him to go with that deal. I says, I just don't have enough guts to do that. And I said, that would be my answer, so I'm not going to do that, and I'm going to go back, and I'm going to sign. So he thanked me, and, you know, that was it. And I went back to Tampa, and I went into Housen's office, and I said, okay, I'll sign. So I signed for a $2,000 cut. And when I started running in the outfield right away, my heels started bothering me. I never said a word to anybody, and I just put the thing in my heel to raise it up out of my shoe. And the first game of the season, I pitched against the Dodgers. It was about the third game of the season at Crosley Field. I came up to hit, and I hit a ball up the middle. You know, I thought it was, you know, going to be a base hit.
Yeah.
I took one step, hard step out of the dugout, I mean out of the batter's box, and I heard the thing pop, went off in my head. Tom Howler, the catcher, he heard it pop. The umpire heard it pop. And that was it. Ted Kluszewski walked down. He was the first base coach. And he said, what happened? I said, it's not good. I said, I did something to my back of my heel. And I thought when I swung, the bat went up in the air and came back down and hit me in the back of the heel. But when I put my foot down on the ground, I didn't have, it's like, you know, like a horse with a broken leg, just sort of wiggling. So that was it. That was it for me. The next day I was under the knife, and that was the rest. I never won another game after that, and you might have said I was in the middle of my career.
Right, and that's that's the tragedy of all of it for a guy that threw so many innings and threw so many pitches and was at the top of his game at 30 years old. It wasn't an arm issue. It was an Achilles, and that's the game really lost out by having you go down like that. However, that 61 and that 61 and 62 team, those were pretty good teams.
Yeah, in fact, from 1961 to 65 or 66, maybe even 67, we contended. It was a whole different thing. There was like 10 teams or 8 teams each league when I started. So they didn't have any playoffs until 70, and then it was the first year that they had playoffs that we were involved. And where you had the playoff, we played Pittsburgh and beat them to get to the World Series. But it was just whoever won the division. And 64, we had a one-game lead going in the last week of the season, and we lost every game the last, I think, 5 games that last week, and finished in second place. So, but, we were pretty much a contender in a lot of those years, so it kept our team all together, and, we came close, but it's like anything else, you got to have, you never know when you start the year who gets hurt, and what kind of guys you got replacing them, if they can do the job, and they do the job. When you're dealing with the human element like that, it's a tough call. When the Reds left spring training this year, I really thought in my mind that, Price and his coaches were going to really have a bang up year and contend, and with a little luck they would win, and all of a sudden guys start falling out, and how they ended up with all those rookie pitchers and stuff at the last month of the year is something. But you don't really know what can happen. Up here in San Francisco, that Hunter Pence, he got hurt 2 times during the year and was out. He was a big plug in their offense and defense also. And there were other guys that got banged up in the first baseman belt. He got, they missed time. But they get guys to come in and they do the job while they're in. And, they came up short this year, but they challenged, But it's tough when you, Walt Jocketty and his, Bob Castellini and Price to evaluate and to see who's going to stay and who's not going to stay. It takes a lot of thought and a lot of luck involved.
Sure does. You mentioned Brian Price. I don't know if you know this or not, Jim, but Brian has a picture of you, a framed picture up in his office in Great American Ballpark.
No, I didn't know that. I think, what was he, throwing darts at it or something when he lost?
I don't know about that, but all I know is, he, as a former pitching coach, Brian, appreciates some of the guys that in Reds history, some of the great pitchers, and he's honored them. I guess with framed photos in his office, and you happen to be up there.
I'll be darned. Well, Brian Price is he's a favorite of mine, and if he gets any kind of breaks at all, I mean, he's going to have some real success as a manager. I mean, he's a sharp business orientated baseball guy, and to go through what he went through the first year. In fact, I told him, I said, we're at Reds Fest, and we were going up the stairs there to go to get on the stage, and I said, hey, Brian, I said, and he was there with Jay Bell. And I said, I want to tell you something. You guys made it through this year. I says, believe me, and as I'm telling you, you'll never, ever have another year like that. It's all going to be up from where you were last year. So he thanked me for that, and I couldn't believe it. They had a worse year, I mean, the way the injuries and stuff. So maybe I better just keep my mouth shut, and go on about my business.
Maybe he was throwing darts at your picture down there.
What's that?
Maybe Maybe he was throwing darts at your picture.
He was. He had it up there in the men's room or something, throwing darts at it or something.
Well, if anyone knows about managers, that would certainly be you. You played for the great Fred Hutchinson and also Sparky Anderson. What can you tell me about those two individuals that that maybe you've learned something from or something specific that you admired about those guys?
Well, I think Hutch was unique in the fact that he was a very tough person. If you didn't hustle, if you didn't run balls out, if you didn't fundamentals, you kept missing cutoff, man. I mean, you're going to get the riot act read after you. And he was tough and gruff that way. And he could chew you out. He'd chew every, call a meeting, and he would chew everybody out, chew the pitchers out. They're giving up too much or two more runs. We'd get, you know, and all this kind of stuff, and you got to do this and you got to do that. And he'd call you in your office, and, you know, he may read you the riot act. But once you left his office or you left the clubhouse and went out to the ballpark or went out to the field, never held a resentment against anybody. And that's pretty tough. I mean, that's a pretty tough thing and a unique thing that a manager, you know, can talk to somebody and maybe they don't get along with them and he can read them out and this and that. But after it's all done, you know, he's going to treat you just like a normal person. And that was one thing about him. Now, Sparky, I ruptured my Achilles tendon early in the year, his first year, and he was sort of a whole different type of a manager just the first year. You know, he started the first year he managed, they won. You know, they won and went to the World Series and got beat by Baltimore. But, you know, the success he had, it was Cincinnati. Then he went to Detroit. And the kind of pitcher, I know, he was one of the guys that they called him Captain Hook. He would take pitchers out before they wanted to come out. You know, that may be a little bit different today. It's, you know, you go out and ask a pitcher today, you say, well, how do you feel? They want to know. They don't tell you how they feel. They tell you ask them, how many pitches do I have? You know, so it, but he, you know, I didn't know much about Sparky Anderson than what he did and the success he did. But the bottom line, Jamie, is that I think that if you don't have the horses, you're not going to pull the coach. Sure. And if you got the horse, you're going to pull the coach. And when the Reds left spring training, they had the horses to pull the coach. And you know, just bad things kept on happening health-wise to a lot of those guys played.
Jim, were you ever ordered to plunk a batter?
Ordered to what?
Plunk a batter.
Get a batter?
Yeah.
No, I didn't need it. I didn't need to be ordered.
You knew
nobody had to tell me. You know.
You knew when to do it and when not to do it.
Well, in our day, we sort of monitored our own deal. The players, the teams did, and you know, Frank Robinson would be on the plate, and he got hit a lot. He'd stand up close to the plate. He got hit a lot. Guys try to pitch inside on him and get hit. And, you know, just a little story. I was pitching in Crosley Field against the Dodgers, and Drysdale was pitching. And Drysdale threw one inside and hit Frank. And so he goes to first base. And so when he came back in, I just walked down to where Frank was sitting. I just walked down and I said, hey, Robbie, I said, who do you want me to get? You know, I asked him. And he said, I don't really think he was throwing at me. You know, he was honest. And I says, okay. I said, I'll put a stop to it anyway. So anyway, when I came up to hit, I walked around their catcher, Roseboro, and stepped, you know, I said, before I stepped into the batter's box, I told Roseboro, I said, if that Drysdale hits one more of our guys any time during this ball game, I'm going to make sure that I hit you with my best fastball, and I'm going to try to throw it right through you. And his eyes got as big as saucers, but, you know, we didn't have any more problem that day.
And, you know, some of the people that are listening probably don't realize that, you know, at the time you were ticking it up there at about 99. So I know John Roseboro probably wasn't you know, too keen on the idea of having one go right through them.
Well, you just go about it. Nobody knew in a sitting in the stands that what was said or anything like that. And we had no problem, But, nowadays, as soon as, somebody gets hurt, then if somebody's going to retaliate, it's right away the umpire's stepping in there and he's going to, next thing, the next ball's close, he's throwing you out of the game and that kind of thing. So,
they've really kind of made it a, with the warnings to both benches, it almost kind of handcuffs the relievers that come in, after the fracas, if you will, and, they can't pitch inside, or if they do, they get thrown out of the game. And then that kind of, puts the managers at a disadvantage. So I'm not sure. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll tell you what, you have to pitch inside. I don't care who you are. And when you start pitching inside, I didn't make a living pitching inside, but when I pitched inside, I wanted to make sure that the guy thought I was going to pitch inside, so I would always throw the ball inside at least 6 inches or to a foot inside. And he would think that, and not trying to hit him or anything, just try to pitch the ball inside, get him off the plate. And I would do that, but I would never try to pitch a strike on the inside corner because that was my ball sort of tailed back. And the left-hander I had early in my career, I found out if I try to make an inside strike, I would strike the ball inside a little bit and the ball would come back over the plate. And then the left-hander, he would get a good piece of the fat part of the bat on the ball. So and then when I threw the ball inside further on the left-hand hitter, my ball would come back and get to the inside corner. The umpire, 9 times out of 10, would call that a ball. So either way, I was not gonna get my call. So I decided that I want to make sure that they think I'm pitching them inside. So I always, if I got one and one or two strikes and a ball, and if I wanted to go inside, I would go inside bad and get them off the plate. And they were in the hitter's mind, they think he's trying to come inside. But if you just go keep throwing outside and outside and outside, that guy's going to start leaning over the plate and, getting some fat part of the bat on the ball.
It wasn't uncommon for you back in your playing days to have to face guys like Gibson and Drysdale and Marichal and Koufax. And, it was a pretty fantastic era for pitching back then. And, yourself included, what was it like pitching against those guys?
Well, number one, if you got into a game with them and you're pitching, which I pitched a lot, you used to have number one would pitch against number one. I mean, that's the way they would line you up, your best against their best for one game. And so I had the opportunity to pitch against a lot of times against Gibson and Koufax and Marichal and some of the other top pitchers in the league. But the thing of it is, when you Major League Baseball, it really, that when you're pitching against Koufax that you might be able to give up one run and you might be able to come out okay. And if you give up two runs, you might be questionable. If you give up three runs, your team's not going to win that game. Well, that's pretty much the way it went, So, but every game that I pitched, I tried to, I went out there on the idea in the back of my mind that I was going to go one pitch at a time. And I did this from pretty much till when I started. That was the thing that I felt that I could pitch a no-hitter every time I went out there. And that's the way I pitched the game, whether it was Gibson or somebody else, a pitcher that was pitching, maybe a pitcher they just brought up from somewhere. And I tried to pitch a perfect game every time I went out. And if somebody got a hit on me, then I was going to pitch a one-hit shutout. Next hitter, work on him. And if he happened to get a hit, then I was going to pitch a two-hit shutout. And if I give up a run, I was going to I was going to stay in a three-hit, one-run ball game. I just sort of stayed one pitch and at how the moment was and still had the goal of not giving up a hit after that point or a run.
Who were some of the tougher batters that you had problems with?
the guys, I had two guys that hit with power that were really, you know, I got them out, but they were really tough outs for me. One was Willie Stargell with the Pirates, the left-hand hitter. And the other one was Willie McCovey, the left-hand hitter for San Francisco Giants. You know, I pitched against Hank Aaron for 10 years and Roberto Clemente and Willie Mays for 10 years. And I didn't really have too much problem with those guys. I mean, they got their hits. And I think Aaron, of all the home runs he hit off, he hit five of them off me. But I had, you know, you're going 24 times a year, you're playing Milwaukee, or I'm pitching against him. I don't know how many times and how many at bats he had against me. And but McCovey and Stargell were tough outs. Now another guy that hit me pretty good that I sort of played around with was a guy named Rusty Staub. And Rusty Staub was a first baseman for the Houston Astros. And he was a line drive type hitter, left-hand hitter. And I could throw anything up there, and that guy would get two or three hits off me every game. I'd throw curves, fastballs, changeup. My changeup was mediocre anyway, but he'd get hits. I could throw my glove up there, and he'd get a hit. So I told John Edwards one day going to the ballpark, I said, you know what? I said, this Staub, I said, he hits everything I throw up there. I said, I'm just going to tell him what's coming. And so we started the game, and Staub came up. He was either the third hitter or the fifth hitter or something like that. I can't remember. But we're in the Astrodome, and so I got the ball, and I walked down off the mound onto the AstroTurf, and Staub was in the dealer, and I looked at him, and I said, fastball. I turned around, and I went to the mound. I wound up, threw him a fastball, and he took it for a strike. Then I got the ball, and I walked down off the mound, off the dirt, down onto the AstroTurf, and I'd say, curveball. And I'd throw him a curveball, and he'd just sit there and look at it. And I did that the first time up. I told him whatever pitch was coming, and you know, after that, I don't think the guy got two hits off me the rest of his career, off me. So, you know, whatever it did, that was a way. I wouldn't tell anybody how to do that, but that worked with his the mental part or something. I don't know. It did something to him.
That's great. Yeah. Now, you played with guys like Pete Rose, Tony Perez, Lee May, one of my favorite guys, Veda, Frank Robinson, Joe Nuxall. What was it like playing with some of those guys that I don't know if you knew at the time whether they were going to be Hall of Famers or not, but you know, you probably knew at the time that these guys were something special.
Well, yeah, that's you know, Pete came up in 63. That was my third year there. And so he started second base. And, you know, he'd run the first on a ball four, he'd run to first base as fast as he, you know, he did on a hit. And, you know, they started calling him a hot dog and all kinds of stuff. And they thought, you know, this is that. But then after a few years, that's just the way he played. And plus, he became a real good hitter. I mean, he worked on his hitting day in and day out. And, you know, he was one of those guys who could get hits. And he hit a home run once in a while. And but he always gave it 110%, whether it's stealing bases, running. You know, he did the very, very best he could. And Perez, when he came up, he was a tough guy with guys on base. And right from the word go, he was your RBI guy. And he was a good hitter. And Lee May was he had a lot of power. And I remember going to L.A. and I say this to Lee every time I see him. You know, whether it's fantasy camp, I'd always bring it up to him. He always got a kick out of the story. And my folks used to come out there. You know, they'd go up to San Francisco and we played up there, and we go down. They'd follow us down to L.A. when we played down there. So I told my dad, I says, man, we got this ball player, Lee May. I said, you ought to see this guy. This guy can really hit. And I built him up real good because he was. He was a good hitter, and I was watching him hit every day and playing good. But he'd go out there, and I'll be darned, he'd get up, and they'd throw Drysdale, and he'd go 0-for-4 and strike out three times. And, you know, I don't think he'd get a hit, you know, for three games. And I tell my dad, I said, well, you know, that really wasn't me hitting up there. He says, well, I don't know. He said, he didn't look too good in there. And I tell Lee that, and he says, well, that's that Drysdale slider. He says, it was a hard pitch to hit, he says, and this and that. But, you know, hitters go into slumps, you know. And if you catch somebody that's in a slump, you think, well, that guy came, what's he playing in this league? And then catch him 3 weeks later, and he's hitting everything lights out, you know. So that's the way it went. And with Johnny Bench, when he came up, he sort of had the Hall of Fame written on him from the word go. And, you know, Veda Pinson was a guy that was really under the radar, outfielder, center fielder. Great little hitter, could run like a deer, and hit close to 300 every year, hit 20 home runs, you know, and was a good outfielder. And nobody really heard too much about Veda Pinson, you know. He was a wonderful, wonderful teammate and a great player to have on your team, you know. That's the kind of guy. So, and then Nuxall, you know, Nuxall came, and when I first got up there, he had a big temper, and they sent him. They sent him to Kansas City. That was in 1961. Mm-hmm. And I came up in 60. And, you know, the fans in Cincinnati were actually booing him because he really had a temper, terrible temper. He went to Kansas City, and he pitched over there during that year. That was the year that we won the pennant. The next year, they got him back. And he went down to San Diego and pitched the first couple months of the season. He learned to control his temper, and he learned a little bit more about pitching, and he came back up, and, you know, the rest was history from Joe Nuxall. He was a great little pitcher there for about 5 years with us, and then he went from the pitcher's mound right up into the broadcaster's booth, and, you know, I don't know how many years, 40-some years, I guess, was there.
How about Robinson?
Frank Robinson was another guy you knew had Hall of Fame written on him. He was a hard-nosed player too, you know. Those guys in those days, I mean, today you see guys, they hit fly balls or they think a ball's going to go out of the ballpark. They don't run. They watch it. You know, they watch it, and then all of a sudden it goes off the fence, and they barely make it into second base. Whereas if Frank Robinson hit a ball, and he knows, all hitters know when they hit it good. Sometimes they don't know they hit it out, but they know it's going to be up against the wall or close to being out. And Frank Robinson would take off, and he wouldn't look at anything. And if the guy came off the wall, Frank Robinson's not barely making it in a second. He's already standing up at third because he ran all the way. And these guys today, not all of them, but a lot of them, they'll just look there at the ball and all of a sudden, I've seen him get hold to a single because they don't run. They think a ball's going out, and the wind holds it up or something. And, you know, it's and I don't know if anybody says anything to him or not, but I guarantee in my day, they would definitely. Somebody would say if it wasn't a player, it was a manager. And usually it was a veteran player would take the person aside like a rookie or somebody and say, hey, we don't play that way here in this league.
Mm-hmm.
We go all out on everything. So,
Jim, how was your relationship with the Cincinnati media?
I didn't have any problem with I didn't have any problem that way. I didn't have any problem with umpires, but the media we had. Lou Smith was a writer for the Enquirer, and he was like a ghost. You never saw him. You know, I never even knew what Lou Smith looked like. And one day we were on a plane. I said, well, who's that guy sitting over there? So that's Lou Smith. Really? You know, because he would never come in after the game. He would listen to the game on the after the game, start of the game, and stuff, this and that. Mm-hmm. And that's where he got his quotes. You know, he got his quotes off there. And we had a guy writing for the Post-Time Star, Earl Lawson. And he was a nice guy. And he would write, you know, he would write baseball. He'd get quotes from the guys. And whenever it went on in the clubhouse, stayed in the clubhouse. You didn't have to worry one thing about him. The Dayton Riders, Ritter Collette, Cy Burick, they were wonderful, wonderful guys. And then later was a guy named Jim Ferguson. Yep. And he went on out to San Diego as a PR guy. And then I think he's worked in the Major League office, I think, after that or something. I don't know. But so I didn't have any I didn't have any problem. I sort of have fun with them, really. I can tell you a story that my locker at Crosley Field is when you had to go up a ramp and go up to the through the doors, and when you hit the doors to get into the clubhouse, you had to make a right, and on the right-hand side there was a manager's office there, and then you sort of had a bare left to get into the clubhouse area where all the lockers were. And my locker was right on the corner. It was the first one that the right you would see. If somebody walked in, you would see my locker there. And so anyway, I was having a rough go, and anyway, I pitched a ball game, and I got rocked around a little bit. And so I go to the ballpark the next day, and then they got the newspapers in there. They have them in there. You guys can read them and stuff. So I look at the headlines in the sports page, and it says, "Will the real Jim Maloney please stand up?" Remember that TV show? What was it? What's My Line or something like that? Did you ever see that? Or was that before your time?
A little bit before, but I'm familiar with that show, though.
Okay. And it says, "Will the real Jim Maloney please stand up?" So anyway, I got a sort of a chuckle out of that, you know, this and that. And so anyway, I don't know. I went out. I don't know if it's the next game or whatever it was, but we were in Crosley Field, and I went out and I pitched like a two-hit shutout, and I struck out, you know, 10 or 11 guys or whatever it is. Had a good game. So I run in the clubhouse, and I pulled my chair out, had a wooden chair, and I told Bernie, the clubhouse guy, Bernie Stowe,
mm-hmm.
says, "Bernie," I says, "let me know when the writer, Ritter, Collette, and the writers, they all came up together, every one of them, they put them in the clubhouse." I says, "let me know when they're coming up that ramp." So Bernie was looking around the corner, and he says, "here they come." So I had all my clothes off. I didn't have anything on. Stood up on the chair, buck naked. I stood up on the chair, and these writers all come around, and they come around the corner. I was the first thing they saw, standing there with no clothes on a chair. And they stopped in their tracks, and they said, "What's going on?" And I never smiled or nothing. I just said with a dead face, I says, "This is the way you told me to, will the real Jim Maloney stand up? So here I am." No, that's a stupid thing. I mean, I don't know if I'd do that today or not, but I doubt it. But I was a little bit goofy in those days, I guess.
You know, you tell a great story about Johnny Bench and a certain foreign substance on a ball. Would you care to talk about that a little bit?
No, I'd be glad to. Johnny Bench came up 1969, I think it was, and at that particular point, I was working on another pitch. You know, I was probably losing a little off my fastball, and I never threw a slider. I just threw first fastball, curve, and change. Now, these guys today, they got sinkers, cuts, fastball, fist seams, insta seams, split fingers. I mean, they got all these kind of things, and they can't throw half of them for strikes, so I don't know what good does it do, you know. But anyway, in those days, so anyway, I was trying to come up with another pitch. I didn't want to throw a slider because I felt it took something away from my curve, and I had a good 12-6, you know, off-the-table curve. So I was told, you know, I don't know if that's a myth or not, that when guys start throwing sliders, they lose their good curveball. So I didn't want to get into that deal. So anyway, there was some guys throwing some spitballs in those days, and the umpires sort of looked the other way a little bit. Nobody said anything except the hitters. The hitters were complaining a little bit. So I started, when I was home that winter, my wife's OBGYN delivered our first daughter, and so he became a good friend of ours. He was a Yankee friend, he and his family. And so he told me, we started talking about spitballs, and he says, "you know," he says, "I got this KY jelly." And he says, "you probably could, you know, get a good spitball with that, you know, if you want to try it." And I says, "well, okay." I said, "was it, you know, it's clear?" And you put it on, and the more you sweat, the slicker it got. You know, I mean, it's the, you know. So anyway, I took a bunch of tubes to spring training, and I started fooling around with it. Well, I ended up, I had a good one. I mean, I had one that was unhittable. And it was also, if you didn't know it was coming, like a catcher doesn't know if it's coming, mm-hmm. it's it was uncatchable. I mean, it was that wild of a pitch. I mean, it was a tough pitch. And so anyway, I was fooling around with his pitch, and Bench had come up there. So the first game of the season, or second or third game of the season, I can't remember, Bench is going to catch. And so he says, I said, we're going over the hitters before the game. And I said, Johnny, I said, I got this new pitch, this KY jelly ball. I says, you'll need a sign for it. I said, well, you know, I'll have to give you a sign to let you know that I have it on the ball and it's going to come on the next pitch. And he says, look at me, and he says, you throw it, I'll catch it. You know, he was really cocky when he was 19. He's probably, you know, still going that route, but he was really cocky in those days. And he tells me to throw it, I'll catch it. And I'm thinking, okay. So I didn't say anything at the start of the game. And I had it on the back of my neck. And I'd go up and adjust my hat. And I only threw it when I needed it. I didn't throw it every pitch. Like Gaylord Perry had that grease ball. He pretty much threw it every pitch. You know, he had the Vaseline.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, we'd go along, and I got two quick outs. And then I thinking, well, okay, he calls for a fastball. So I had it loaded, called for a fastball. And he doesn't know it's coming, so I throw it. And he didn't even get a glove. It went up there, exploded, and hit him right in the toe. He even touched it, and that ball kicked off, and he went down on one knee, and I heard him yell a little bit. And so I went up, walked halfway up there, and the umpire threw me a ball. And so I'm looking at him. He doesn't do anything. So anyway, I turn around and go back to the mound, get the guy out. Next inning, same thing. I get two outs because I don't want to throw with a guy on third base. I mean, he's not even going to catch it. You know, right. There's no way. And so I got two quick outs, nobody on. So same thing happened. I loaded it up. He calls for a fastball. I called for a curve. So I shook him off, and he comes with a fastball because I got it loaded. And so I wind up, I throw, and I let it go a little bit high. Started out maybe shoulder high on the hitter. And then he come out of his crouch a little bit, come up with his glove, and the ball dropped so fast, so quick, so hard. It came down, and he never got a glove on it. Hit him right in the cup and broke his cup in half. And he's on all fours, and he rolls over on the home plate right across the field there. So I walk up there, and he's moaning and groaning and making all kinds of noises. And the trainer comes out, and the trainer's lifting up on his belt. You know how when guys got their wind knocked out of them, they on their belt? He's doing that. And finally, two or three minutes go by, he gets up to one knee and this and that. So I got another ball from the umpire. I walk back out to the mound, and I turn around, and there's Bench right behind me. And he's about 2 feet standing there looking at me. He's got his mask up on his helmet, and he looks at me and he says, I think I need a sign for that pitch. So maybe I taught him a little humility that day. You know, I don't know.
That's fantastic.
He tells that story too, you know, when he could ask him about that. He tells it. He's not embarrassed to tell it, I guess.
Well, Jim, it's been a pleasure. I've taken up a lot of your time, over an hour today. And, you know, I just want to let you know how much I really appreciate you coming on. And especially to your wife as well for arranging this. But, you know, I could talk to you probably for all day, once a week if I could. And, you know, I would love to have you back on the podcast if you'd like.
Well, hey, thanks, Jamie. I appreciate it. And you're still doing your Better on Red, right?
Yeah, you got that right. Yep.
Well, I always say when I go into the website, I always go in there and I check you out. You don't know I'm checking you out, but I do check you out. So keep up the good work and keep on doing what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate it, Jim. Thanks so much. And, you know, tell Lynn I said hello.
Okay. Thanks, Jimmy. Bye-bye.
A big thanks to Jim Maloney for joining us from his Northern California home. I wanted to get Jim on the show because, as you heard, he has so many great stories and is such a valuable resource for baseball information and insight. Not only that, but Jim has been so friendly and kind to me over the years. He's one of those guys to whom you only need to tell your name once because he'll always remember you no matter who you are.
I always think about what kind of career Jim Maloney could have had had he remained healthy. And of all the injuries to sideline a pitcher, it wasn't an arm or elbow issue. It was a ruptured Achilles of all things that cut his career short. Can you imagine that big red machine with a still in his prime Jim Maloney in the rotation? I hope you'll join us next week as we welcome to the show two-time Gold Glove second baseman Pokey Reese. The music you heard on the podcast this week was courtesy of 11th Day Dream and their record Works for Tomorrow, which is available now on iTunes. Thank yous go out this week to Jim and Lynn Maloney, the Cincinnati Reds, and Lisa Braun. And a special thanks to our talented technical director, Nick Prince, without whom this podcast wouldn't exist. That's all from BOR headquarters. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jamie Ramsey. Expect good news.